From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. After the first debate, the TV pundits said Kerry crushed Bush, and later the polls confirmed that. After the next three debates, when the talking heads claimed a winner, they often missed the mark, and the viewing public knew it. Throughout the process, there was another debate, both inside and outside the media, over what the media ought to be doing. Prognosticating seemed to be just another kind of filler, as were the often unreliable instant polls and certainly the forays into the spin room. The anchors all conceded that point, even as they jawboned with campaign mouthpieces. And since last month's 60 Minutes scandal over forged memos, TV has a growing credibility problem. During Wednesday's debate, Kerry cited the findings of two networks that found that the president had distorted his health care plan, and the president quipped,
"In all due respect, I'm not so sure it is credible to quote leading news organizations about..." Oh, never mind. Anyway...
But the fact is, the media actually did shed some light on the debates by doing more of what they should have been doing all along, checking the claims, the accusations, the facts of the candidates. CNN.
500,000 kids lost after-school programs because of your budget.
Wrong. Bush did propose cutting $400 million in after-school funding in his 2004 budget, but Congress refused to go along. No children lost their program.
He's proposed $2.2 trillion of new spending, and yet...
Bush was using an old figure from the Conservative American Enterprise Institute. An analysis by the nonpartisan Concord Coalition says Kerry's proposals will cost $1.3 trillion. That group put the very same price tag on the proposals of George W. Bush.
The only problem is, simply listing the lies is not enough, because some lies matter more than others.
On October 8th, a memo from the political director of ABC News, Mark Halperin, was posted on the Drudge Report. Halperin wrote, "We have a responsibility to hold both sides accountable to the public interest, but that doesn't mean we reflexively and artificially hold both sides equally accountable when the facts don't warrant that." And he noted, "Kerry distorts, takes out of context, and makes mistakes all the time, but these are not central to his efforts to win." On the other hand, Halperin added, the Bush campaign is attempting to, quote, win the election by destroying Senator Kerry, at least partly, through distortions. The right-leaning media took Halperin's call for a more honest accounting of the president's statements as proof of ABC's liberal bias. Others, like Washington Monthly writer Kevin Drum, took up the gauntlet thrown down by Mark Halperin and ran with it. He joins me now. Kevin, welcome to On the Media.
Hello, Bob.
All right, now you came up with a mathematical equation, or at least a system, to quantify the lies of the second debate. Can you explain your methodology?
First, I looked at each statement to see if there were any factual errors, and I ranked that from 1 to 3 points. And then I looked to see if there was a real intent to deceive, as opposed to just being a small exaggeration. Again, gave it 1 to 3 points. And then I added that up, and I multiplied it by the importance. Obviously, Iraq and the conduct of the war on terrorism, those are important issues. Taxes is a very important issue. On the other hand, Bush made a misstatement about wetlands protection. That's just not an important issue in the campaign. So I multiplied the whole thing by either 1, 2, or 3. And I came up with a score for each misstatement.
Now, this is probably the central reason Halperin was accused by some on the right of political bias, is that his evaluation is that the Bush attacks on Kerry are more distorted and twisted and out of context than the Kerry distortions about Bush's record. Does your calculus verify Halperin's conclusion?
Yeah, it did. You know, I sort of forgive politicians for minor lies. You sort of expect that. But George Bush had, by my count, 7, you know, very substantial misstatements in the second debate, and Kerry didn't have any. Kerry had some misstatements, but they were all fairly minor. Bush had the minor ones, but he also had a lot of very serious misstatements as well.
So, in the Kevin Drum Candertron, Bush's score was 118 to Kerry's 51. What are the big lies that you caught Bush in that pushed his number so high?
He said at one point, and this sounds kind of wonkish, but he said non-homeland, non-defense discretionary spending was rising 15% a year when he got into office, and he's wrestled it down to 1% a year. Now, first of all, on a factual basis, that's way wrong. The figures are very clear that that kind of spending has increased way more under George Bush than under any president since LBJ. And then on the second thing, was he really trying to deceive? You know, he absolutely was. I mean, he's trying to imply that he's gotten spending down, and he clearly hasn't. That's a big lie. It's both factually incorrect and clearly deceitful.
Now, of course, the question we're most interested in is the press's vigilance about all of this. It seems to me that in the past 3 or 4 weeks, the news organizations, including even the TV networks, have made pretty giant strides in vetting the accuracy and the context of the candidate's various charges. Is this my imagination, or have we come a long way in a very short time?
No, I think you're right, partly right. I've been very impressed with the amount of fact-checking in the networks, in the newspapers, organizations like factcheck.org. They've done a great job of going through all the misstatements, giving the context, and so forth. The one thing they haven't done, and that's what I was trying to do with my analysis, was they haven't put it all together to try to give you a real indication of who's lying more than the other. But I'll tell you something. I think that the increased attention paid to this might have made a difference, because I did notice that, you know, from the second debate, I pulled out 5 pretty serious lies of George Bush's that were domestic policy, and I thought they'd all come up in the third debate. And you know what? They didn't. He softened them all.
And John Kerry stopped using the $200 billion figure that he had been citing in the first two debates as the cost of the war in Iraq to date. That was not in evidence in this week's debate between the candidates.
That's right. So I think this stuff does matter. I think it does make a difference.
Mark Halperin made his assessment and was accused of political bias. Let me ask you about your political bias. I'm just going to take a wild guess and say that you were sort of predestined to find out that Bush is a bigger liar than Kerry, no?
I actually did my honest best to be as rigorous as I could with both guys. I'm a liberal, obviously. I'm more likely to think that something George Bush says is a serious lie. You know, I'd like to see an organization like Fact Check or the Washington Post or somebody who's more neutral than I am go through and do the same kind of thing that I did. You know, don't just write a story listing a few things each guy said, but go ahead, give them a score. And if one guy is lying more than the other, just say it.
Maybe for every election from this point forward, we'll be looking at the drum score, as reported in the New York Times, Reuters, and everywhere else, huh?
So you're saying I should get a patent on it, and maybe I can get royalties in future elections?
I'm like, yeah. Kevin, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Kevin Drum is a writer for Washington Monthly.
So, after examining our own media, we wondered how the debates, in fact, the whole campaign, was playing overseas. Slate contributor Ed Finn has been reading the foreign press, and he joins me now. Ed, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, how did the most recent presidential debate play over there?
Well, it was very big, very important, a lot of editorials and a lot of focus.
Are any of the articles written in terms of winner and loser like they are here?
People tend to avoid that in Europe. They would report the polls that said that Kerry was successful, but in their analysis, they tended to say more that there is a big conflict and clear differences. Let me give you an example here from Le Monde. In their main article on the debate coverage, they titled it Deux projets radicalement opposés pour l'Amérique, which is two plans radically opposed for America. And that was really the main thrust of a lot of European coverage, was that these are two very different men, but we, as the European commentators, are not really ready to say there's a clear winner in this. European papers tend to be more comfortable either quoting American sources or even interviewing bona fide Americans to find out what's going on in the U.S. One great example of this was from Der Spiegel, the very popular German magazine, in their interview of Woody Allen.
They interviewed Woody Allen about the American election?
That's right. And their first question was, Mr. Allen, do you see your president as a comic or a tragic figure? Allen said that Bush himself is rather comic. When you listen to him speak, you sometimes just have to laugh out loud. But if he were to be reelected, that would be a tragedy.
So as you read through the press, are you detecting a rising level of anxiety?
I think, actually, the people are slightly less anxious now that Kerry has pulled ahead in the polls, because for most of the world, they really want Kerry to win. I think one of the quotes that summarized global opinion about this election best actually came, ironically, from the Arab News, which is an English-language daily in Saudi Arabia. They said, of all elections on the face of this earth, the American presidency is one of global importance. Even a mountain goat on the backside of the Himalayas is interested in the outcome, since it might mean certain death from carbon monoxide or life under a healthy ozone.
I understand that the left-leaning Guardian newspaper has taken a very participatory approach. They're urging their readers to adopt an American voter in a swing state and actually to write to them.
That's right. They moved straight past anxiety, right into activism. They're encouraging their readers to send in their emails. And in return, The Guardian will give them the name and address of a particular voter in Clark County, Ohio. They're all registered independent, which, as The Guardian says, somewhat increases the chances of their being persuadable.
They were very careful about saying how you should approach that prickly beast known as the American voter.
They say, keep in mind the real risk of alienating your reader by coming across as interfering or offensive. You might want to handwrite your letter for additional impact, and we strongly recommend including your own name and address. It lends far more credibility to your views, and you might get a reply. Finally, post your letter soon.
What was the overall impression of the process, the American presidential debate circus, so to speak?
I think in Europe, people were surprised at the debates, at the level of passion that both candidates showed, and also almost confused because it's so strange for Europeans to see an America that has been so determined, so forthright with George Bush, often going its own way, to see that strong single voice be caught in debates where Bush often looked flustered or upset, and both candidates were really fighting. And it was remarkable, I think, for a lot of Europeans to see an America so polarized.
Polarized, but also perhaps democratic?
Absolutely. One Australian editorial in the Daily Australian really brought that point home. The editorial said, anybody who likes to flatter themselves that we focus on issues while U.S. politics is all about personalities would have been brought up short by three debates in which two articulate spokesmen for their respective causes distinguished themselves carefully on myriad issues, domestic and foreign, over a total of 270 minutes of live television. And when you think about that, that really is remarkable.
One last question, Ed. There's been a story that's been floating around a lot on the internet, and it's even gotten some traction in the mainstream press, and it involves a bulge that was detected under the president's suit jacket during one of the debates. The president's bulge is something between a rumor and a mystery, and I wonder how it's playing in Europe.
It's pretty exciting for the Europeans, and it's really been playing, actually, all over the world. A quick Google search shows you websites in Japan, Bangladesh, Brunei, Australia. Most of those papers added nothing to this story.
Ed, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can find Ed Finn's blog at edfinn.net.
Coming up, more on the Battle of the Bulge and is texting making us dumber.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. When George W. walked out on that stage in Arizona this week, viewers at home could be forgiven for trying to cop a peek at the president's back. Whether or not they could detect something there, between the shoulder blades, under the suit jacket, roughly the size of an iPod, probably depended on their predisposition to a certain rumor churning through cyberspace. To wit, the president is wired.
They have a picture of George W. Bush from the first debate, and in his back, there is like a big lumpy bulge. And people were saying, well, you know what that is? That's a radio receiver, and somebody is feeding him answers to questions.
The persistence of the speculation, especially on the internet, but also in some corners of the mainstream press, finally elicited some response from the Bush campaign. Probably just a wrinkle in his jacket, they said, but definitely not an electronic device. Slate's Deputy Washington Bureau Chief Chris Sullentrop joins me now from the Kerry campaign trail to examine this story. Chris, welcome back.
Good to be here.
So where is most of the coverage of this mysterious bulge coming from?
There was speculation about this in 2000, believe it or not. But the thing that really kicked off this latest wave was an article in Salon.com. And then that kicked off a big liberal blog wave of chatting and then sort of percolated up into the New York Times. And from there, it got into the Associated Press. I saw a picture of it on headline news.
The Washington Post's Mike Allen wrote about it.
That's correct. It's an interesting way that the fact that rumors are printed gives them more credence, some sort of importance that they wouldn't be if they were just, you know, in the grapevine. So it's been some interesting decisions made by various White House and campaign reporters about how to deal with it. And there's just this question of, if people are talking about something, does that mean we need to cover it? And different people have different answers for that.
And what's your answer?
I think it's definitely a story to write about. A line I had in a piece I wrote about this, I said, you know, just because the Umbrella Man didn't shoot John F. Kennedy doesn't mean there wasn't an Umbrella Man and that we don't want to know, you know, who he is. I don't know if you need to write about everything people are talking about, but, I mean, I think the press obviously missed the Swift Boat story for a long time, something people were talking about, and the press just sort of ignored it. And they missed the story in a lot of ways. I've never seen a wrinkle in somebody's clothes that came out as a rectangle. So, you know, I think it's a real question.
You mentioned the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth story. That's a pretty important story. They were telling a lot of whoppers and they were given free play in most of the media for most of the time. This story doesn't rise to that level. You have to, I guess, weigh the importance of one story against another.
That's absolutely true. But then that you face up with the question, well, what? If a charge is even more serious, then you're supposed to write about it even more? I mean, that can't possibly be the judgment that you make. Well, the more outrageous the claim, the more likely we need to write about it. Though the idea that the president has a radio transmitter in his ear is preposterous on its own.
Why is that preposterous?
Well, it's not preposterous. I suppose it's a serious claim, you know.
And, it's a serious claim, deserving perhaps of serious attention?
I agree with that. The fact that it was at a presidential debate is what makes it serious. But people are starting to ask questions about it. I don't want to sound like the White House press is totally ignoring this. They want to ask McClellan about it in the gaggle. They want to ask him about, look, the president skipped his physical this year. Does he wear a back brace? And they just want to get an answer on the record from them. Right now we're getting a lot of the White House says go talk to the campaign. The campaign says go talk to the White House.
You know, we talked to an expert in conspiracy theories some months ago, and he said that they always spring up in the absence of good, credible information. In a sense, by not really responding to the question, the White House is adding fuel to the fire.
I'm sure that's right. People say Roswell sprung from a PR blunder. If they don't explain to us what it is, I think this continues to dog him, at the very least, as a joke.
So the White House would like it to go away. Do you think reporters would also like it to go away?
Probably. I mean, look, I think reporters want to set the agenda and not have the agenda set for them. And for better or for worse, if they feel like they've gotten pushed into this story and they don't think it's worthy of covering, it's the kind of thing they want to go away.
You know, it's funny, but whenever you get an uncomfortable story like this, I remember this happened to me when I was media reporter for National Public Radio and the issue of the infamous semen-stained dress from the Monica Gate scandal came up. NPR said to me, cover the coverage of the dress. And really, that was the only coverage NPR did for a while. It seemed to inoculate them from the nastiness or the improbability of the story and yet still get it on the record. Do you find that a lot of mainstream reporters are using the excuse of covering the coverage to cover the story?
That's right. Now it's covering the blogs or covering the buzz on the internet. So you can say, well, we're not giving credence to this story. We're just covering what people are chatting about online. And some of the people that have sat out the story have said, look, we don't want to do that story.
Do you think the internet is helping reporters to get to the bottom of this, or is it having the effect of discrediting the whole story from the outset?
I think the latter. I mean, I think that the idea that there was a rectangle on the president's back became obscured by the fact that all these left-wing bloggers were saying the president is wired, which was sort of a leap unsupported by the evidence. And so then people immediately dismissed the rectangle and said, this whole thing is phony, this is coming from partisans. Now, having said that, without them, would we be talking about it? I don't know. It's a good question.
Okay. Chris, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Chris Sullentrop is Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for Slate.com, and he joined us from the Kerry Campaign Trail in Des Moines, Iowa.
Last week, a South Missouri State University student photographer named Amanda Stratford was assigned to shoot a campus political rally for the school newspaper, The Standard. The event was underwhelming, and Stratford's focus wandered toward the crowd. Later, she overheard a participant talking to police about a stolen American flag, a theft Stratford realized she might have photographed in progress. She volunteered to let police look at the photo, but instead they seized her digital camera and its memory stick. With that, the student journalist entered the annals of conflict between media and law enforcement. The Standard sought legal counsel from the Student Press Law Center, a national organization that advises student publications, and Executive Director Mark Goodman joins me now. Mark, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Mark, first of all, where does the case stand today?
Well, at this point, the police have returned the camera to the students, and they are discussing their options. I think the frustration that the students have is that the police at no point have admitted any mistake, and the fear is that this same kind of incident could very easily happen again if the police don't have some recognition that the action they took was inappropriate.
What action was appropriate for police to take when a photographer approaches them saying that she may potentially have evidence of a crime?
The issue here was the confiscation of the camera. The police wanted that camera instantaneously, even though they had seen the image already and had the information that it contained. I don't want to suggest that one couldn't understand the police's motivation here, but I think what we have to recognize is that has to be balanced against the journalist's obligation to be able to cover the news. We see this situation coming up very frequently with college journalists when, you know, fights or riots break out in or around college campuses, as sometimes happens after major athletic events. And, you know, a college newspaper photographer may very well be on the scene and get some great pictures of it that allows the community to better understand what actually has happened here. Well, when the police demand that those photographers turn over those photos, what that does is makes it much less likely in the future that that journalist will be able to get those kind of photographs again. Suddenly, the journalist becomes an investigator for the police department, and folks are just not going to look at the news organization in the same way after that.
Is there a circumstance that would make you more comfortable about a news organization taking that risk of being associated with the police and willingly surrendering a memory stick or anything
right.
else?
Well, you know, I think most news organizations say they have no problem with providing information that they have already published. And in fact, the newspaper ultimately published this photo, and so anyone who wants to see it can. Beyond that, though, when the law enforcement agency is asking for, you know, outtakes or unpublished photos, you know, I think it's a very rare circumstance where a journalist can sacrifice their independence without there being really societal loss as a result of that. Now, I think many journalists, if they felt that lives were at stake or people were going to be injured as a result of information they had, would probably choose to provide that.
In defending its right to protect its own photographs, the Standard, the newspaper, cited the 1980 Federal Privacy Act. What does that act allow?
What it basically does is prohibit law enforcement officials from confiscating a journalist's work product, except in very exceptional circumstances. Basically, when there is evidence that the journalist in question has committed or is in the process of committing a crime to which the materials relate, or that the immediate seizure of the materials is necessary to prevent death or serious harm. Clearly, neither of those are relevant in this context.
Finally, this happened on a college campus. The principals were a student newspaper and campus police. Does anything change if this were happening elsewhere in, you know, adult life?
Not at all. And I think students are perhaps a little more subject to this kind of intimidation by law enforcement officials because they know better than to try these tricks with a commercial news organization. But the principals involved are exactly the same, and the damage to, you know, the public's right to know are no different.
Okay, well, Mark, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Mark Goodman is executive director of the Student Press Law Center, headquartered in Arlington, Virginia. The typewriter, the telegraph, the television, the advent of each new communications technology brings the inevitable cries of horror from language purists who fear for dear old English. And just when we thought it was safe, along comes text messaging, which is now gaining traction here in the United States. Texting is a way to send typed messages discreetly and in the middle of class, for example, over your cell phone. It has spawned a written lingo of sorts, mostly among teenagers, a combination of abbreviations, acronyms, and emoticons that to the uninitiated looks like secret code. Some are even calling it a hybrid language. Here to tell us how concerned we should be for our beloved English are two linguists, Jeffrey Nunberg from Stanford and Naomi Barron of American University. Naomi, Jeff, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, so earlier this year, Microsoft condensed a portion of the Iliad to 32 lines of text message lingo and sent it to 6 million members of its MSN Messenger service in Britain. In text lingo, the word two, T-O, is replaced with the number two, and other words are changed to reflect their phonetics. For example, what is spelled W-O-T. The chairman of the Queen's English Society called the Microsoft synopsis appalling. Jeff, do you have a similar reaction?
Oh, I think it's funny, don't you? I mean, it's a form of language that's designed for a certain purpose. In the same way that when I take notes, I write W slash for with or BC for because. And I'm not tempted to use those if I'm writing an op-ed piece.
Naomi, your reputation on this subject is more of a curmudgeon than than Jeff is suggesting. Should we be worried that English standards are just slipping away?
We know that children learn to talk because there are some people, we call them adults or older kids, who already know the system. And the younger kids pick up an awful lot of what we model for them. My question is not, can you have a range of different registers, some informal, some formal, some texting, some essays that you turn in for class, but are we modeling those more formal forms of writing that we used to, and I don't think we are so much anymore.
The more you write, the better you write. The best way to learn to write is not to learn the rules or take courses, just sit down and write. To that extent, I think you could argue that the kids who are now doing text messaging and email and IMs and so on and so forth will wind up writing at least as well as and possibly better than their parents or than any generation in history.
I'm afraid I have to disagree. Jeff, as we know, is an eloquent writer, but I guess I don't buy what I'll call the comic book argument. As long as they're reading something, even if it's comic books, their reading isn't that terrific. We all do a lot of talking, but we don't necessarily become more eloquent just because we have talked for more years.
I think it's important to realize that the alternative is not the same kind of alternative that you have when you talk about the question of, well, should they be reading comic books or should they be reading The Tempest? Because the fact is that when these kids are sending emails or text messaging, they're doing it not in place of writing a letter to the editor at the New York Times, but in place of having a conversation. That is to say, writing as a means of expression is a much more important part of their lives at all levels than it was for us. And the idea that kids are somehow going to be incapable of learning other forms of writing because they've learned this quick form of text messaging just seems to me wrong.
So what do you say to the middle school teachers who are pulling their hair out when the essays that they assign come back with the word because spelled C-U-Z and no I's capitalized and so on?
If kids do it occasionally, it's the kind of habit they're easily broken of.
Those habits are easily broken if somebody cares to break them. Because one of the things that is happening is there are a number of teachers, middle school, high school, who are saying, at first, I was really concerned about this. And then, as Peter Sellers would say, I learned to love the bomb. And I said, this is being creative. I shouldn't touch it.
You know, people have been complaining about the language of adolescence forever. And they're right. The history of 16-year-old speech is an unbroken catastrophe going back to the flood. So in that sense, you can think of these complaints about text messaging as just the latest in a long series of complaints about how the English language and the way we use it is going to hell in a handcart. And they couldn't all be right, or we'd be bears today.
What does this current style attached to text messaging bespeak for the future of the English language? Is there any prediction that we can make about what's going to happen from this point forward?
Well, if you look at the history of English, you'll find so much about the language goes in cycles. If you go back to the 16th century, people didn't care terribly much about spelling. Then there was a long period of centuries where they did, and now perhaps we care less. Similarly, there used to be an awful lot of abbreviations and acronyms, particularly in the late manuscript period, early printing period, far more than there have been, say, in the 19th or even the 20th century. So it's really hard to know whether the kinds of abbreviations and acronyms that come up, not just in texting, because first they were in IM and before that they were in email, whether those are going to maintain into the regular offline language.
there's a complicated relationship between technology and language. People used to say that because of the telegraph, reporters were wiring their stories in. Stories and sentences both became shorter, and that affected the English language. And it's certainly true that between the late 19th century and the 1960s or 70s, the average sentence got a lot shorter, whether you're looking at the New York Times or best-selling novels. Whether you can actually make a causal story that connects those two is a lot more complicated. It may have been just something that was in the air. So to that extent, I think you could say that text messaging will be part of what happens to the language, but I think it would be going out on a limb to say it will cause anything to happen to the language.
If I get a vote in all of this, let me just say that both of my teenage children are prolific text message users, and I'm delighted they're using shorthand because I'm paying the bills and they're already just exorbitant. I want to thank you both. Naomi Barron is a professor of linguistics at American University and author of the forthcoming book Beyond Email, Language in the New Millennium. Jeffrey Nunberg is a researcher at the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford and author of my favorite title of last year, Going Nuclear, Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, an old-fashioned battle for the airwaves, the elusive October surprise, and local news is neither local nor news. Discuss.
We will. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last week, Sinclair Broadcast Group announced that its 62 stations would preempt their usual programming to air a commercial-free documentary critical of John Kerry. The film, called Stolen Honor, will be aired on stations across the country sometime between October 21st and 24th. Criticism from Kerry supporters was swift, but the regulations that govern politically charged broadcasts just weeks before an election are complicated. Earlier this week, Democrats filed formal complaints with both the Federal Election Commission and the Federal Communications Commission. Sinclair claims it's just getting out the facts, and it has offered Kerry an opportunity to answer questions on the air, but the Kerry camp has declined. And the battle rages on.
Now, the critics haven't actually seen the film, but they know the filmmaker and they know Sinclair, which regularly airs the conservative commentaries of its executives. Earlier this year, Sinclair also famously stopped its ABC affiliates from airing Nightline's controversial recitation of the names of soldiers who died in Iraq. The question is, does Sinclair have the right to require its stations to air a smear, assuming it is one, just before the election? Should it have the right? We're joined by Andrew J. Schwartzman, executive director of the Media Access Project, a liberal media watchdog group. Andrew, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
First of all, let's once and for all talk about the equal time rule and how it applies or doesn't apply in this case.
Sure, there's been a good bit of confusion about this, Brooke. The equal time law says that when one candidate appears, the other candidate receives a right to appear on the station. In this case, the opposing candidate would be George Bush, because the person appearing in the documentary is John Kerry.
So basically, the equal time rule is all about face time. It's not really about defending yourself against attacks.
That's right. But there was, until calendar year 2000, a rule that rather precisely applied to the circumstance that we're dealing with here. It's the personal attack rule, which said that when somebody's honesty, integrity, or similar qualities are attacked on the air, the person who is attacked has a right of reply. Now, this was thrown out by a court in Washington, D.C. on very technical grounds, having nothing to do with the constitutionality or the legitimacy of the rule, and it's something that could be reinstated. But as of now, it would provide no relief to Senator Kerry.
So, Andrew, what rules do apply in this case, or do any of them?
First of all, there's nothing wrong with Sinclair or any other broadcaster running any programming. The question is, once they do, what obligations they incur afterwards. As to that, it's a little hard to tell until the program is actually broadcast, but it may well be that there is no direct right of reply that Senator Kerry would have unless he wants to buy time on Sinclair, which he does have a right to do, and he does have a right to specify when, more or less. However, the FCC does examine a broadcaster's overall performance when its license is up for renewal, as several of Sinclair's licenses are right now, and a very good case can be made that there is a pattern of abuse on Sinclair's part, the kinds of things that you mentioned in your intro.
Is that abuse, though? Isn't an owner of a broadcast station allowed to program as they see fit? If they don't want to run a Nightline show, there's no law that says they have to.
There is an obligation in a very broad sense to give different points of view and an obligation to make sure that the public is well informed. Hearing one side on all of these things doesn't always accomplish that.
What do you think Sinclair has to gain by behaving in such a blatant way? Is this just a maverick broadcast group, or do they see some profit in this?
I certainly don't know exactly what's behind it, but I do know that Sinclair has supported George Bush. It's lobbied for ownership deregulation. It's received some ownership deregulation, and it certainly looks like they're returning the favor.
You've said that there has been nothing close to this in your memory, which I know is pretty long, Andrew. So what are the conditions you think that's made this peculiar situation possible?
Well, for better or worse, the electronic media as well as the print media have become increasingly partisan and increasingly pointed in their programming. Sinclair is a different species of broadcaster. Sinclair, in many ways, models itself as the on-air Fox News channel.
And this identity is occurring not in cable, which is not regulated by the FCC, but on the broadcast airwaves, which emphatically is still regulated because it's a limited resource.
If we were talking here about 3 or 5 or 7 television stations, we'd be very angry, at least I would, but the effect would be rather limited. What we've got now, though, is a broadcaster with 62 stations, 2 in many of its markets, and located in markets in swing states. So the political clout that comes with the FCC's ownership deregulation has greatly exacerbated the problem.
I knew eventually we'd be able to blame all of this on media consolidation. But the fact is, even though you have a situation in which there are 62 stations instead of 3 or 4 stations, would even those 3 or 4 stations a few years ago be allowed to conduct themselves that way? And is there anything in the law to stop it? And should there be anything in the law to stop it? Should the government step in and tell them what is balanced and what isn't?
Well, now we're getting to the broader question of the Fairness Doctrine. The Fairness Doctrine, which was rescinded in 1987 by the FCC, served some very, very important purposes. First, it required broadcasters to do controversial programming, and then it required that in their overall programming there be some degree of balance. That's missing from Sinclair's operation, and I think that we're all the worse for it.
Now, a lot of people have called for a boycott of Sinclair's local advertisers. If there is no recourse in government, and perhaps there shouldn't be, can the public make a difference?
Historically, boycotts have not worked very well, but that was pre-internet. The blogosphere has taken this thing up with a vengeance, and it could well be that Sinclair will feel economic pressure sufficient to make it rethink the virtues of this very partisan approach.
Andrew, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Andrew J. Schwartzman is Executive Director of the Media Access Project, a nonprofit media watchdog group.
Several reliable polls suggest that for most Americans, local television newscasts are a prime source for news about their communities. But are they a good source? The University of Wisconsin and the Lear Center at the University of Southern California found that in the weeks leading up to the 2002 elections in the top 50 TV markets, 56% of local TV newscasts didn't air a single story on any campaign. OTM's Paul Ingalls reports on why some news departments steer away from political coverage, while others push themselves to break new ground on the subject.
What this isn't is a typical day on the campaign trail.
During the 2002 election season, Wisconsin Public Television's Jerry Huffman anchored a series of reports showing what happened when the candidates for governor allowed the TV station to temporarily take control of their campaign schedules.
Instead of a day of choreographed events and bust-in supporters, the seven gubernatorial candidates have agreed to follow us all over Wisconsin to meet one-on-one with voters.
The series earned a Lear Center Walter Cronkite Award for news producer Andy Moore. In an interview with the Lear Center, Moore said at first some of the candidates resisted this stab at political reality TV, but when some agreed, the others signed on for the ride into the unknown.
They were extremely uncomfortable. Some of them handled it better than others. And the more uncomfortable they felt, the better job I felt that we were doing.
The Wisconsin Public Television effort stood out amid a local TV news landscape where truly innovative reporting on local politics and government is rare.
News about our democracy is being pushed out of the way by a concern about live, local, late-breaking coverage, which so often is about crime.
That's former CBS producer Wally Dean, who helped conduct a 5-year study of local commercial TV news content for the Project for Excellence in Journalism, which found, to no one's surprise, 60% of lead stories were about crime, disasters, catastrophes, accidents, unusual weather. In other words, anything that might include an emergency vehicle. Dean says stories on politics and government account for just 10% of local newscasts. Because, he says, news managers believe, or are told by their consultants, that politics is boring to viewers, and that police tape and flashing lights are eyeball grabbers. However, Dean's research also says if done well, political reporting can still help stations win.
And we found that stations who have the best ratings and share retention from their lead-in programming actually run more political and business stories. They can survive and not run yellow police tape, but we've got to convince them.
Karen Foss has anchored news at KSDK in St. Louis for over 20 years and appeared with Wally Dean on a panel on local news held in Albuquerque in September. She says her station tries hard not to overdo crime coverage and to sometimes tell the more detailed political story. But when they do, they often get the call the next day.
Those who are the consultants and the analysts sit down and look at minute by minute where the viewers have been. They will say, last night that story ran 4 minutes and 20% of our audience left. And it really, there'll be no reflection on whether that was an important 4-minute story.
Foss says the electronic meters hooked directly into TV sets that count audience in such detail in larger markets like hers are one factor that could be reducing civic reporting. In medium and small markets, ratings are usually drawn from old-style written diaries that can't single out a 4-minute report on local government as a viewer loser. It may, in fact, draw viewers, says Susanna Schuler, news chief of Nexstar Broadcasting, which operates 25 medium and small market stations. She says people tend to be more active in local government in smaller communities, and therefore more interested in seeing such stories on the local news. Just how interested they are remains a mystery to local news managers.
We tend to be more civic-minded than our viewers, but sometimes we don't know if that's good or bad. If that means they are or they would be if we just gave them more coverage, or if they're saying, I don't care about that stuff. Go tell me about the traffic accidents and the, you know, the fires and the piddly little stuff that we think, you know, who does that affect? Not many.
Schuler, Foss, and many local news directors surveyed by the local TV news project last year say they don't have enough reporters to cover the news of the day in their market, much less to do investigative reporting about politics and civic issues. Critics of local TV news say shrinking staffs are a result of increasingly consolidated corporate ownership, cutting back to keep profit margins high. They ask, why not settle for slightly less profit in the name of the public interest?
You can't go to Wall Street and say, well, now we're only going to make this much. Are you still going to support us?
Susanna Schuler of Nexstar.
You would have to get the entire industry on board to change that, and I don't see that happening.
So if getting more reporters isn't likely, the challenge then becomes how to do effective political and civic reporting on a shoestring. USC's Lear Center insists it can be done, so its annual awards acknowledge the best practices in reporting staples like candidate profiles, pieces exploring voters' concerns, and stories that check claims in debates or candidate and issue ads, like this report from King TV in Seattle.
Watch the commercials for Referendum 51, and you'd think this vote is all about your safety. Reality check?
Jill Geisler is on the faculty of the Poynter Institute for Media Studies, which trains professional journalists. She says one way to deepen coverage of local democracy in action is for television newsrooms to recommit to beat reporting, assigning a reporter to cover City Hall, the State House, or the congressional delegation, and not pulling them so often to cover breaking news.
When you walk the halls of power, you frequently see what I would call anticipatory journalism. It's the tip that someone gives you about an idea that could become a proposition, that could become a bill, that could become a law. And you as a reporter are telling that story to people at a time when something can still be done about it.
In the long run, says Geisler, the news story content mix, particularly on local commercial news programs, rests in the hands of the viewers, who can vote with their remotes by clicking to and staying with stations offering serious coverage of local issues and politics. For On the Media, I'm Paul Ingalls.
Surprises. We love them. Except, that is, during election years and months beginning with O. Then we get a little suspicious. The phrase October surprise was first applied to a rumored intervention of sorts during the Carter administration. Hostages were being held in Iran, but toward the end of Carter's term, there were increasing signs that they would soon be freed, perhaps in October 1980, of an election year. Barbara Honegger, a researcher and policy analyst with the 1980 Reagan-Bush campaign, alleged that Reagan operative William Casey made a deal late that summer with an Iranian cleric to delay the release. The charge was never proved. The hostages were released on Reagan's inauguration day.
Thus, the first October surprise was an alleged effort to foil an October boost for an incumbent. Since then, of course, it's been applied retroactively, for instance, to candidate Richard Nixon's successful attempt to hobble a Vietnam peace agreement taking shape in the last days of the Johnson administration. Nixon sent word to Saigon that South Vietnam would get a better deal under Nixon than Hubert Humphrey, and Johnson's peace initiative fizzled. Surprise! No matter. Nixon told voters that he had a secret peace plan of his own. Surprise again. Suspicions about October surprises, intentional or accidental, by the incumbent or the challenger, date back at least 50 years, when Dwight Eisenhower got a boost from the Suez Crisis, right up to the last campaign, when the Democrats were charged with unearthing George W. Bush's decades-old drunk driving conviction on the eve of the vote.
Fast forward to 2004. Recently on ABC Radio, the president's political mastermind Karl Rove told conservative talk show host Sean Hannity that, quote, "We've got a couple of surprises that we intend to spring." So come on, we're midway through October already. What's it going to be? Political junkies are trawling media's dark alleys for a fix. The internet provides a slate of tantalizing possibilities, courtesy of such sites as Octobersurprise.net and OsamaBinLato.org. Which also offers the opportunity to wager. Everyone's number one pick is, of course, the capture of Osama bin Laden. In second, third, fourth, and fifth place, America attacks Iran, America attacks North Korea, the election is postponed due to red alert, and last but not least, Dick Cheney is dumped from the ticket.
Although our favorite option comes further down the list, weapons of mass destruction found in Iraq. What could be better than that? I mean, we believed it before. So did Congress. The administration had access to all sorts of conflicting information at the time, but it really wanted to believe it, and we know that's what matters. The problem for the politicians, of course, is that the public is growing ever more skeptical of announcements from the podium or the campaign trail. They've heard it all before. Maybe the surprise of October 2004 is that you really can't surprise the American electorate anymore.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keith is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Ann Kosseff and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.